The following podcast is brought to you by the Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing Program at Dominican University of California, under the direction of Dr. Judy Halebski, and is offered publicly as a service to the creative writing community.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm really thrilled that we have Ashley McMullen with us. I learned about her work through the Nocturnists, which is a group based in San Francisco, but that seemed to have, I think, a national, international pull. I'm sure Ashley will introduce us more fully to the Nocturnists, but my understanding is that it's a podcast series and live storytelling event series of people working in the field of healthcare telling stories. And they did a really fantastic Black Voices in Healthcare series, which Ashley McMullen was in charge of creating. And they also had a really interesting, really heartwarming COVID series about COVID. And you might remember, some of you that were here at our earlier retreat, the Nocturnists, we had Emily Silverman and Adelaide join us and speak about the work they were doing. I'm honored to introduce Ashley McMullen. She is a physician, a native of Houston, Texas, who ventured west to complete her residency training in internal medicine at UCSF, where she served as chief resident. Currently, she is a primary care physician at the San Francisco VA Medical Center. Ashley is interested in exploring the role of narratives in medical education and as a tool for improving healthcare across differences. What a fantabulous fit for our work here on narrative medicine. So we're just thrilled to have Ashley. Ashley, welcome.
Thank you so much, Judy. And thank you guys for joining and taking the time out of a Saturday afternoon to hear a little bit about our project. I guess I can, you know, just briefly tell a little bit more about myself, even though I'd want to thank Judy for that excellent introduction. I'm from Houston. I've been in the Bay Area for about 6 years now, just moved across to the East Bay. But yeah, narratives in medicine has been something that's near and dear to my heart before I even knew what narrative medicine really was. And this Black Voices in Healthcare series was a culmination of a lot of hard work among the Nocturnus staff, and then myself and Kimberly Manning, who also joined on as producers and hosts. So I'm happy to share a little bit about the series, talk a little bit about my philosophy about narratives in medicine, and anything else you guys want to hear.
Great, Ashley. Should we play a clip to set us off, to get us started?
Yeah, I think, well, maybe before we play the clip from episode number one, what I can share a little bit about the series is just how it came to be. And so the idea actually came about in May 2020, right in the immediate aftermath of George Floyd and his murder, that set off a spring of protest. And for myself, I was, going through a lot of emotions, got a lot of texts, both helpful and unhelpful, from various allies. And, Emily Silverman and I, we overlapped a little bit in our medical training. She was about 2 years ahead of me in residency. And at the last live Nocturnist event before COVID had shut everything down, I had actually gotten on stage and told my own story, which had a lot to do with race and identity and my hair, actually. And so Emily and I became a lot closer after that, and just kind of sharing authentically about our individual experiences. And so both having this heart for storytelling, she had actually reached out and was wondering if there was a way to use the Nocturnist platform to try to shed light on the experiences of Black people in healthcare. And so that was the context in which the series started. And we just put out a call for stories, which I can talk a little bit more about later, but we just sent out messages through social media and through our networks of Black voices in healthcare to share, you know, authentically what emotions they were experiencing when they first heard about George Floyd. And so we can play some clips from episode one.
Great. So Ashley, you put out a call and various people submitted recordings of themselves speaking.
Exactly. Yeah, it was, you know, and we really did not know how this was going to go. You know, when Emily and I first talked and then invited Kimberly Manning on board, and we just kind of like, you know, we're just going to ask folks to share their stories, to pick up the phone, record themselves in their own authenticity, not scripted or editorialized, and see what comes through. And the response was overwhelming.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, great. So should I play? I'll play episode one. Yes, episode one again. That's the title? Okay.
Yeah.
Here it is.
I know exactly where I was when I heard about Mr. George Floyd. I was sitting at my kitchen table when I was writing, and I was actually very upset in the moment that I was writing. Along with the added terror that I've been feeling for weeks about COVID-19 and Black people. Not just for my patients, but for myself too. So I'm sitting at my table and I'm writing about all of this when my husband calls out to me from the other room, "Baby, did you hear about this dude in Minnesota?" And I look up and I say, "No." So he starts walking toward me, and the truth is, I wasn't even alarmed yet because we share stuff with each other all the time. And I mean, it could have been anything, right? Like, I mean, a brother could have won a lottery, but he showed me the video. And he didn't give me, you know, the warning that you give people. And that is because we have an understanding. We look. But I looked and saw a grown man with his entire weight on another man's neck, with his hands in his pockets, his brow furrowed, and a snarl on his face, and a little tiny smirk, and even heard him utter the words, "Don't do drugs." As another dude stood by with his hands in his pockets. And that isn't the kind of fine detail that just being told about it would give me. I needed to see that. So yeah, we agree to honor your life and acknowledge what happened to you and the atrocity of what you dealt with by looking. I remember when I was in college and I watched that grainy video of Mr. Rodney King being beat with billy clubs by a pack of police officers. They beat the shit out of Rodney King. He was down already. And I'm glad I saw that video, because seeing that video, it helped me reconcile coming back to Los Angeles, my hometown of Inglewood, and seeing things burn to the ground. Because if you saw that video and you saw the way they whooped his behind, I mean, he was defenseless. And you heard that verdict and saw that nobody went to jail, oh, you would have been mad too. So I watched the video, and no, I didn't feel particularly despondent or anything. I just felt mad and just tired, man. Like, damn, we stay losing again. I will always look.
When I watched the video of Eric Garner's murder, I cried like a baby. I was, even now, talking about it, I immediately start to cry. And I watched George Floyd's murder, and I didn't cry. But I didn't watch it to the end. I couldn't. It's the callousness of it. You know, when that officer looked at the camera and knew he was being recorded and didn't care, that to me showed how dehumanized we have become. And there's video. So I now, you know, focus on the fact that no one would have believed this possible if there were no video. Not only did George beg for his life, beg for his mother, witnesses begged for his life. And the two and the three co-conspirators did nothing but watch a life go away. I had trouble working for several days after that. I just didn't know what to do. To think that we're still in this position, that this could happen. But Reverend Al did a good job of putting it into context. I just wanted the knee off my neck. That's all. That's all I've ever wanted. Just get out of my way. Stop putting up barriers. Stop pretending you're good. Stop pretending your coworker's good. Just leave me alone and let me do my thing. Just leave me alone. And I realized that the only way that I got here to this position, made it through to have multiple board certifications and do a lot of good to help people is because of faith. Just like Al said, we've come this far by faith. But that doesn't mean I'm not tired of this, because I am.
Wow, just so moving, such strong stories. But one of the things that, thank you so much for bringing these to us, Ashley. One of the things that stands out to me from that story was this kind of focus on, like the first speaker talking about, both of them, the speakers talked about, I had to look, I had to see, right? This idea of to look directly, to not ignore, to address, being heard, almost like, and it seems that part of the work of this series is to amplify that and to add like more perspectives to it. Is that how you saw it, or?
Yeah, you know, I guess, I mean, to be fair, I wasn't exactly sure what we were gonna do or what we were doing in the beginning. But you know, it's so, I think, first of all, the stories are just so humbling. You know, I think even as, you know, someone who identifies as Black, it's not easy to be that authentically emotional, especially publicly. But there's so much power in that authenticity. And I think also recognizing, and I selected these two clips, of course, you know, there's several more in that first episode, but just kind of recognizing, or, you know, part of humanizing people through storytelling is recognizing that, you know, every human is complex and different. You know, it's interesting from the first clip, you know, as a physician who grew up in Inglewood and, you know, viewing the murder of George Floyd through the lens of having experienced, you know, the aftermath of Rodney King. And, you know, in her story, you feel, you know, not just the shock and horror of George Floyd's death, but also just like, you know, the rage and like compounded emotion of just like, yeah, we'd been through this before, like, you know, we're ready to ride. And, you know, in the second clip, you know, seeing it through the lens of a man who just, you know, just that, who just wants to be left alone, just like, you know, just let me do my job, just let me live. Like, why do I have to keep seeing this? And so recognizing that, like, everybody's reactions, everybody's emotions, everybody, even though we share this common identity, like there's so many differences even among us about how we experience life and the realities of racism. And so it's just, you know, exploring that through stories and as a lens for everybody who, you know, either whether you have proximity to the experience or not, to recognize like how expansive this is.
So when you're thinking about this reaching an audience, do you have an intended audience?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting because, you know, the Black Voices in
Healthcare series is a specific series within the broader context of The Nocturnist, which is the brainchild, of course, of Emily Silverman, and has evolved, you know, from, you know, being a couple of physicians in someone's living room to, you know, these sold out shows at various venues across the nation. And so while it tends to be like more healthcare centric, and it was not, you know, and it's not the intent that it is even like doctor centric, ideally this covers the broad range of anybody who has some interaction or interest in healthcare from, you know, the provider, staff, or patient perspective. But, you know, I like kind of, you know, there's a metaphor that she uses around kind of these inner circles that kind of broaden. And in the inner circle, it's kind of like, you know, the intimacy of conversation, storytelling, like talking to a friend about an experience that, you know, that person would understand. And then around there are other folks who are listening in, maybe not in the conversation, but benefiting from, you know, seeing a story being told and its authenticity. And so again, while the, I think targeted audience may be a looser term, I think it tends to be more folks in healthcare, like organically, but I think the intended audience would be anybody who has an interest in health equity or expanding their life lens on experiences that might be different from theirs. And, you know, what the impact is of these very real experiences in the lives of people who are kind of charged to heal others while also experiencing like their own wounds.
Ashley, you got all these submissions. How did you choose between them?
Girl, it was not easy. And I think, you know, and this is where I give so much credit to Adelaide Papazolo, who's the podcast producer and editor, and also had like, you know, these kind of deeper backgrounds in like artistic expression and story design. You know, the fallacy of having a medical degree is that, you know, you know how to do everything else, which is very much not true. I've been humbled many a time, just even with my own storytelling experience with The Nocturnist, that, you know, because you're a good writer doesn't naturally make you a good storyteller and vice versa. And like, you know, what is a story, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and ideally some climax or what have you. And, but I guess, you know, what we were looking for really was like authenticity, like the ability to let emotions kind of come through and tell a story organically without it feeling like scripted. And then also within each episode, we kind of tried to center it around a particular theme. We chose just like one-worded themes. And, you know, we might have like, you know, one outstanding story that is really great, but it doesn't quite fit within the tapestry of like the other stories or kind of like the way we're putting it together. And so that was really hard. But I think, you know, Adelaide had kind of the vision in a little bit more of the time to be more selective with how stories would fit. And so we basically, and we had a group of medical students who also helped kind of do the initial like listening, picking out like which stories kind of met the like kind of compelling, some telling something new, felt authentic and organic, and then trying to distill that down into what could fit into like a 25, 35 minute episode and, you know, become kind of this symphony, if you will. And so you have to have like kind of the right notes and the right tone at the right places.
Fantastic. Ashley, before we go further, I just wanted to ask you about your own, like how you came to this work. Or do you like, so you got up on stage at the Nocturnus and told the story. Was that in keeping with other pursuits you have? Do you think of yourself as a writer, or was that just out of left field for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've always been deeply, felt deeply connected to stories, and reading was actually my early passion. And then, you know, my two dreams of childhood was to become a doctor and to become a writer. And so, you know, it wasn't until actually residency, or actually before residency, that I kind of caught wind of this idea that people can do both. And so I remember reading books by like Danielle Offrey and Louise Aronson, who I got to meet in residency, and Victoria Sweet, and, you know, kind of, you know, the larger barrier was seeing myself in a way that could be on par with some of these incredible physicians and writers. And, but really what pushed me was in my, like my last year of training, I was very, very burnt out. And in ways that, I don't know, made me question like my longevity in the field, which is disconcerting because I was just getting started. And, you know, obviously something needed to change immediately if I was going to continue in this path that I had paid dearly for through a lot of student loans. So yeah, I started writing more as a wellness practice and trying to really kind of get into the stories of patients who I didn't identify with, like the patients who left me like vexed and frustrated. And I found a lot of healing in that, and without really knowing what it was that I was doing or how. But I think that, you know, what I discovered found to be true for myself or my perspective is that, you know, medicine in so many ways has this inertia of dehumanization. Like even the way we're taught medicine is really kind of skewed a little bit more towards efficiency and algorithms. And, you know, even though we know that, you know, it's important to have empathy and be kind and treat people the same, like, you know, there's plenty of data to show that that does not happen. And I think that, you know, it's so easy to kind of build in this distance, you know, both as a protective mechanism, but also to kind of cater to our needs and identities of like who matters, what doesn't matter, which things are important. And so stories to me actually became more of a resistance, if you will, or like a way of slowing down in a world where I'm pushed to be faster and more efficient. And, you know, during my chief year, I started blogging a little bit with, there's a Journal Watch series with New England Journal of Medicine. And so they will have a couple chief residents around the country every year start to write. And so that's where I really started kind of feeling slightly more comfortable with having my own writing put out there, or like my own stories put out there. But it was always kind of projected outward. And then, after chief year, like I went through a breakup, I had like, you know, decided to stop straightening my hair and go natural, like all these transitions. And that's where I started kind of really doing the deeper work of exploring like my own stories, my own identities, and like, you know, where those things intersect with those of like the folks that I'm constantly like in contact with between patients and colleagues and staff, and recognizing like how important that work is to do this job well, to both take care of people and take care of yourself. And so that's kind of like the philosophy behind it for me and where I'm hoping to go forward in my career and kind of teaching these things to younger physicians and medical students and, you know, continuing to explore different mediums on my own. I hope that answered the question.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Ashley, it's so great to hear about your work and hear these clips. I want to point out to our audience, maybe we'll hear another clip and we'll also just, then we can open it up for questions. How does that sound, Ashley?
Yeah, that sounds great.
What should we play next?
I said I was going to make a snap decision and now I can't.
So there's Hair, which you just mentioned, and then there's episode 7.
Stand out. Yeah, let's do the Hair one. I think that'll be good.
Hot combs and subtle groans were hallmarks of my childhood. Two fingers on the back of my ears, I heard the hot comb sear. My desire to look like her helped me conquer all of my fears. By her, I mean sis on the TV screen, hair perm to perfection. Her skin matched my complexion, but at that age, I hadn't yet learned the lesson. The lesson that no matter how much I straighten my hair, I wouldn't be welcome, not here nor there. Professionalism would become the poison of my air. A suffocation that you couldn't believe. Please just let my blackness breathe. My survival, your comfort, seems like I'm always in between. Because in this country, melanation, God's beautiful creation, is seen as something in need of ablation, but still they claim with racism they have no relation. Therefore, my hair has become my not so subtle act of resistance, a reclamation of the crown rightfully ours since our existence. So I feel opulent boardrooms with scents of cocoa and shea, Afro puff proudly on display. Or should I rock my bonnet today? Either way, my blackness has come to play. Black has always been the standard of beauty. Despite what's shown on the movies, I am proud of the resilient roots from which my hair grows, which are part of my history. So sis, go ahead with your 3C, 4C wig, popping, bald and beautiful, short and bold, cornrows, twist out, bantu knots, ponytail, kitchen out, front lace, poof poof, afro, wash and go. You already know, whatever it is, just know you are so beautiful. Black hair is a mosaic of beauty. To protect it is our duty. For too long, we played by the rules never created for us. And now it's time to say enough is enough. So go rock your crown, queen, and tell professionalism to get with it.
I still remember the day I met her on rounds. I'd taken over a service on the inpatient HIV service. And she had been in the hospital about 30 days. And I was getting to meet her on a Monday, taking over service. Young girl, advanced HIV AIDS, battling a couple of opportunistic infections. And she was starting to finally get better. She was being weaned off oxygen and was starting to regain her appetite. We started her on antiretroviral medicines in the hospital. I remember meeting her, and she's probably 24, 25, slightly older than my kids. And all I could remember was how little she looked and how much hair she had. Her hair was big. It was huge, but it was matted. And she'd been in the hospital. She'd been in the ICU. And through all of that, the transfers back and forth, no one looked at her hair. I've spent many years in the hospital. I'm used to bringing in little hair ties and getting out the little rubber bands on my wrist to give to a patient. Because I know Black women, our hair is important. Our hair is part of what defines us. And when people are in the hospital, a lot of times, that just falls by the wayside. The little bowls at the bedside with the one shaving stick and little tiny comb doesn't cut it. It never has, it never will. And there's nothing like having your hair done to make you feel like you're getting better. But this one girl, well, young lady, was just finally getting better. And I told myself I would braid her hair. I'd never done that for a patient, but there was something about her. She had this fight in her eyes. She was going to get better. And I know that just feeling better about how she looks would help. So I asked her how she liked her hair. And she said, oh, she always got her hair done, twists, braids, different things. But in the hospital, it just looked like a big old mess. So Saturday morning, we got done our rounds. It's pretty early. We didn't have a lot of admits. We were pre-call. And I just went into her room and I said, hey, do you want me to braid your hair? She was surprised. She said, doctor, you're going to? I said, sure. I said, I've been braiding my sister's hair for a long time. I have three younger sisters. I have two daughters. I said, I'll braid your hair. I sat by the bedside. I like to tell myself that my hands are soft, no matter how tender your scalp is, because both my daughters used to fall asleep with me braiding their hair. She had her phone on some YouTube video. The Wi-Fi was bad, so it kept cutting in and out. And I braided her hair. I put her hair into 8 cornrows to the back. She looked fabulous. She loved it. She cried. She said, no one's ever braided my hair this nice. I said, I'm sure they have, but I like to think I'm pretty good. But I think just after 32 days or more in the hospital, she just was ready to start looking like she did before she got really sick. But soon after that, she was discharged. Something as simple as just braiding her hair made her feel better.
Ashley, should we open it up for questions now?
Sure, why not?
If anyone has questions, you can put them in the chat, or I'm just going to do a gallery view. You could try waving to us. Pamela, would you like to speak first?
Sure. I'm a nurse, Ashley, and I just want to say simply to you, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for doing this, for this whole program, for the recordings of these voices. It's very powerful. I just retired after 45 years of nursing, and I just published a poetry chapbook. And one of them that did not get published is about braiding hair. Now, I was told, this is so interesting, I was told I could not braid hair, touch the hair anymore on the psychiatric unit that I was working on, because the touch of someone else could not be done. It was now considered inappropriate. And I said, you cannot define my practice. And I left. I knew that the touch of human beings in this situation is holy work. And I'm not going to go on about me, but I am so excited that you are doing this. And the work that I've done with physicians over all the years, it's been very, very difficult for them to come out and be as open as what you have recorded. It's been very painful. And for all of us, you know, but particularly, I think, in medical schools and the different work that I've done. So I just want to say thank you. You're very brave. You may not like to hear that, but I do believe you are. And I'm very grateful. So thank you.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you so much. You know, My
mom's a nurse, and I'm hoping that, you know, she's heading for retirement soon. But that actually is what inspired me to go into medicine is seeing the nursing side and her relationship with her patients. I didn't actually know any doctors before I had decided on medicine. But, you know, one of the stories that stands out to me is when my mom started her career kind of at the height of the HIV epidemic in pediatric nursing. And she had made a decision to hold babies who had contracted HIV when other people would not touch them. And so, you know, the stories of nursing and what nurses do is part of why I am who I am. So thank you.
Jermaine, I see you've got your hand up.
Yes. Hello. Thank you very much. This is very important, especially the component regarding the hair. too many times people don't mean to insult us about our hair, but people who do not have hair, like Black women, Black men, I wear my hair natural as well, but I've taken to covering my hair because I just got tired of people saying, when your hair is straight, it's so pretty. And that's really offensive because my hair is naturally kinky and curly. And when people would say that my hair looked beautiful and I looked beautiful when my hair was straightened, they were applying a standard to me that was not natural for me as a Black woman. And it's really a hard point to get across to people. I'm a nurse educator. And so I've been in the nursing portion. I spend most of my time in education, but people need to realize that our hair is our hair. My hair is not naturally straight. It grows in curls and kinks and coils. And I think one of the hardest things is when people do think that they're offering a compliment, but, and you are supposed to take it as such, but it's not really, because they're not complimenting your natural hair ever. When I wear my hair in twists, like when I was at Dominican, I wore my hair in twists, and you know, people don't compliment that. They compliment what is the European standard of straight. And so this component on hair is just such an important conversation to have. And the fact that no one, that the doctor addressed in the dialogue about the combs and the brushes and the things that are supplied in the hospital, they don't work for us. You know, they just do not. I cannot get that kind of comb through this hair. And so I think that's also important. What the doctor said was, you know, nobody did her hair. And our hair will get matted. It will start to lock. And so it's so touching to hear a doctor, a physician speak on hair. And I'm so proud of my doctor sister who is here and providing us this information. I think it's very, very important. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for sharing. Yes, been there. And I think it's, before I could even like start to love myself more, I had to start to love and appreciate my hair and its natural form. And not to say that anybody who is Black and wears their hair straight is, you know, choosing, you know, one alternative over the other. But it is kind of hard to break through, you know, those standards of beauty and really, you know, rock your crown, as our med student said when she was doing the spoken word on that first story. So it's true, but it's amazing what dialogue can come out of a story. And, you know, I feel like we can speak so much more through just telling our experiences than kind of like, you know, going at each other and making things more difficult to engage in dialogue. Stories, you know, they speak for themselves. And so that was before we'd even like knew what we were doing or what all episodes we were going to do. We knew we were going to do an episode on hair. So I would encourage folks to definitely check out the full episode if you have a chance.
So we have, I'm hoping we'll be able to hear one more clip before we wrap up, but I see the telephone number has their hand up. I don't see a name associated with you. Do you want to ask your question? Can you hear us?
It's the 747 number.
Maybe there's a technical issue. If you do want to ask her a question, you can just speak up. Should we listen to the last clip?
Yeah, let's go ahead and fire that up.
And that's from episode 7, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Growing up, ballet was the air I breathed. My mother put me in classes before I turned 3, mostly because she didn't know what to do with a child who couldn't make it from A to B without bumping into something or tripping. But from the moment she put ballet slippers on my feet, something just clicked for me. know, I don't know if it was the music or the discipline, but to this day, I get uncomfortable talking in front of more than a couple of people, but dance has always been a way for me to tell stories. And so for the first 15 years of my life, it's what I did. You know, by the time I was in middle school, I was taking ballet classes 4 days a week. I was dancing with a professional company on the weekends, and this was going to be my life. So it culminates for me with a big audition in my eighth grade year. And I am feeling really good about it. You know, it did not matter to me that there was nobody in that company that looked like me. I believed that by showing up and showing out, by doing the work and putting in the time, that there would be a place for me, that I would make a place for me. And I'm feeling good about this audition. And day of, I am moving through the cuts and feeling really good until, of course, you know, I'm cut and completely devastated and trying to get out of that space before I dissolve. And I see the director of the company making her way towards me, and I just brace myself, steady myself for them. And she comes up to me, she says, the point of a ballet company is to see the company, not an individual dancer. And your look is too distracting. You know, at this point, I cannot for the life of me conjure up the complex insecurities of a 12 or 13 year old girl, but I can recall with acute pain what it feels like to have your appearance just dismissed as distracting. I walked out that day and I didn't come back. I found an all Black company to dance with and I explored other forms of dance. And although they didn't resonate with me in the same way, they did help me start to do the work of feeling comfortable with owning the space I occupy. You know, several years later, I found myself now with a new passion, medicine. And again, finding that there were few people that looked like me. But I believed, I resurrected this belief that there would be a place for me. And so I think I was a third year medical student and I am rounding with a group. I'm the only person of color. And we go in to see this patient and he's an older white man. And he must not have seen me initially, but at some point during the patient interview, he goes from being completely consumed by his pain and limited mobility to just pivoting and losing his mind. You know, he's saying, I did not sign up for this. Get her out of here. I do not want this Black bitch in this room. And I am standing there in my short white coat, cheeks are blazing, looking at this red-faced man just angry at me occupying space. And my colleagues are there silently looking back, wide-eyed between the two of us. And it is humiliating. My attendant jumps in and just expertly diffuses the situation, redirects, wraps up the interview, and ushers us out of the room without ever addressing the language or the racism that transpired in that room. And so we get into the hallway, and I am just fully expecting that there's going to be a debrief. You know, in looking back on that situation, I am looking for recognition and validation and accountability from my attendant. And instead, he says to the group, you know, we're going to round on this patient again tomorrow, and turns to me and says, I think it's best that you stay in the hallway because having you in the room is just too distracting. I mean, really? Thank goodness I had parents and mentors that told me otherwise, because 10 years later, that is still the best you can do. I was at one of those middle management meetings, and we were doing an icebreaker. You know, those ones where you have to choose. So, okay, if you want chocolate ice cream, you go left. If you prefer vanilla ice cream, you go right. But the question was, choose your superpower. Is it the ability to fly? Or is it the power of invisibility? And I was frozen. I could not choose. I mean, obviously, I could not choose the power of flight. I'm totally afraid of heights. I mean, Ferris wheels is kind of like my high-end heart flutter. Yeah, give me some benzos for that. And I definitely would not want to be invisible. I mean, my superpower is the exact opposite. My superpower is that I always stand out. Now, for some people that might be uncomfortable being the fly in the buttermilk, the grain of pepper in the salt. In other words, the only person of color in a very large bed of white folks. But my parents helped me understand that that was my superpower. I knew early on that you don't have to bother trying to fit in with them. You never will. So don't bother. Don't play their game. Create your own game and invite them into it. Because in your own game, you are the leader. And it's always been my superpower throughout my entire life, knowing that I'm always going to stand out and relishing in that. The standing out was really apparent in those residency interviews, completely standing out from everybody else. You know, usually, what do you wear to an interview? You've got that navy blue suit or the black suit, and ooh, maybe you're going to go for a pantsuit instead of a skirt. Wow. Now, I don't know about you, but in the 90s, they really didn't make those in maternity size. So I popped out in the most gorgeous floral green dress that accentuated my gorgeous baby bump at 7 months pregnant and waddled into every one of those residency interviews. Talk about standing out in this line of applicants in their uniforms. And here's the sister with the big belly and the bright green dress. It was glorious. And yes, I matched in my first choice.
Yes, I love both of those stories so much. That was from the episode on standing out, which I thought was a really big aspect, or kind of this like dual experience of not just being Black, but I think you know, being different in many ways. Of both being hypervisible and invisible at the same time.
Yeah, I felt there was an interesting, like one of the thematics I was seeing was kind of the exclusion, standing out in exclusion, and also the complicity of bystanders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very thematic. Yeah. Did you give much thought to the way those two stories spoke to each other?
Yeah, and again, I just selected two from like the greater greater episode, but those two in particular, you know, I think again, viewing it through the lens of my own experience, you know, growing up very visibly Black, but often being in spaces where I found myself kind of isolated in that identity, that, you know, that desire to fit in and be accepted, you know, at some point you have to make peace with the fact that, you know, in many cases it's just not going to happen.
But in many ways, like, you know, it's a gift, and part of that comes through in being able to share your story. And I love the piece where she says, you know, make your own game, but then invite other people in. And so it's not just, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about race or talk about our different identities, you know, people get uncomfortable in the sense that you're creating more division by speaking about it. But really, you know, it opens a space for us to form connections beyond, you know, these singular identities that are supposed to define everything about us. You know, perhaps, you know, you're not as proximate to the experience of being Black, but, you know, maybe you've been the only pregnant woman going on an interview and then trying to find clothes that, you know, that fit with that, or, you know, wanting to feel good about your hair and your appearance, and that being, you know, an aspect of well-being, that, you know, healing isn't just through medicine, that it comes in many different ways. And, you know, we do that by being seen, and part of being seen is being visible in your own authentic story. And so, yeah, but also, you know, the point of that first story being like, we hear a lot of those types of experiences and they're gut-wrenching. And, you know, the pain of a bystander saying nothing, even if they say the wrong thing, is equally as, I mean, it basically, it erases the experience. And in my opinion, it's kind of like, you know, folks who are colorblind, quote unquote, it's choosing to not see. And that does not help change things. And the other thing that I think is helpful about that story is the myth of meritocracy being the great equalizer. And that's not true either. And that does not, again, solve these very real, real experiences and real issues that create barriers for folks to meet their potential.
I see Suzanne has her hand up.
That was wonderful stories. The voice in both of those was so touching. How are you using the stories? How, you know, are they in published form or? Okay, you get it.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I want to, you know, applaud all of the folks who sent in these stories without, you know, an ask or an expectation. So these were curated for the Nocturnist podcast series. They still are available to listen both on the website and all the usual podcast platforms. And just have been encouraging folks in healthcare and across the spectrum to kind of, you know, use these stories as a way to build proximity to the experience of being Black and healthcare, but also recognizing that, you know, again, that there's complexity in the experience, that we're not all this monolithic group, and kind of like, you know, as a way of generating dialogue, opening up experiences. In my mind, you know, there's a lot of benefit to, like, you know, picking up a book and learning, you know, steps A through Z of, you know, how to not be racist, which there is a lot of, you know, benefit to that. And, you know, I'm not exempt from that either, but, you know, there's something about the human experience told in its truth without editorializing, without, you know, being accusatory, that just invites people in. And I think we need this in so many spaces, especially in medicine, to really start pushing towards, like, pushing past the discomfort of difference and seeing the value in that diversity of experience and that diversity of thought. And I think, you know, this series was mostly like, you know, basically a stepping stone towards building connection, building dialogue, and for anybody to use in ways in which, you know, is helpful. So for many of the storytellers, it's healing just to have your story out there. And for many listeners, you know, it's helpful to be able to hear and see something different than your normal day-to-day, and kind of understand, you know, what it means for others to walk in these shoes, but also recognize that, you know, there might be some aspects of that experience that resonate with you as well.
Ashley, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. You've just shared with us so generously and illuminated the work of the Black Voices in Healthcare series and connected so beautifully, like, narrative and the healing process. Just such a pleasure. We maybe just have one last comment of where's your work going next? What is your plan?
Yeah. So the executive producer, Kimberly Manning, and I actually made a segue and put together a new platform called The Human Doctor. And so that's a new podcast that is out now. And so I continue to work with Emily Silverman and serving on the board of the Nocturnist, and also now going to start working with the Bellevue Literary Review, which if any of you had a chance to check out some of their work, it's phenomenal. And they've just branched out of the institutional structure of NYU and now are their own nonprofit group. So really just continuing to write and tell stories through the audio platform. So check out The Human Doctor if you guys get a chance. And I continue to teach narrative medicine with my group of residents, and doing it in ways that really are trying to make bridges across differences and improve health disparities and health equities through engaging in narrative practices.
Oh, wonderful, Ashley, just fantastic. We put the link to The Nocturnist in the chat, and definitely we'll check out The Human Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us, and keep us abreast of your work.
Of course, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been great, you guys.
So our next session is in 2 hours. It's our keynote with Dean Rader, and we'll see you back then. Thanks so much for coming.